So I'd like to start by welcoming you here this afternoon. So I'd like to begin by introducing myself to those who don't know me. My name is Venerable Nisarino, and I am one of the monks that Ajahn Brahmavangsa ordained. I've been ordained now as a full monk, Upasampada, 19 years. And I stayed with Ajahn Brahmavangsa for 9.5 of those years. And then soon after the 9.5 years, I came to Sri Lanka in 2006. So I have been living in Sri Lanka for 11 years. I always feel I should speak better Sinhala, but my Sinhala is still not very good. But more people understand it, so that's quite good. So, and I live on my own in a cave, a Purana Galvena, in the Balangoda area. It's a group of monks that live on their own. It's a very good environment. Many of you may know of Tanna, the Tanjan Tanna group, and our local Handru, Venerable Vimalanyana. So good. So this afternoon, the theme for this session is thinking, is it a blessing or a curse? How do we relate to it? Oh, I think it's gone. How do we relate to it in meditation and daily life? So this afternoon we can, the format I was thinking of is first a little bit of an introduction, and then to the guided meditation, do a guided meditation, and then for about half an hour, and then have half an hour talk after that, and then a time for Q&A after that. So hopefully we finish by around 6:30. That's the aim for the this afternoon. So it's a wonderful opportunity that we have to come together and meditate. I don't know how many of you meditate, but I think those that do practice and meditation will realize how beneficial, how supportive it is when we meditate in a group. Exactly why that is, I'm not sure. But it is very helpful for us to meditate with like-minded people, and it supports the meditation. It can become deeper. So this is one of the benefits of this afternoon. So the guided meditation is aimed at dealing with thinking, how we deal with thinking in meditation and also in daily life. And the talk will discuss that in more detail, whether it's a blessing or a curse, or a bit of both. I think for most people, thinking causes a lot of problems in their lives. When they think of themselves, sometimes people think very negatively of themselves. Sometimes they are thinking that other people think very negatively of them. They're worried about what other people think. Of course, they don't know, unless they're thought readers, they have mind readers, they can't know. So it's really, that's imagination. So it's very important to get an understanding about thinking, not only for the meditation, because of course in meditation the major disturbance is thinking, isn't it? Thinking happens and continues. It has a momentum of its own. Because we think during the day, we usually think a lot, and then we come to meditate, and then the thinking continues. And I say, is that a surprise? What have we been doing all day? So one of the most important things about thinking in meditation, particularly we're talking about now, is our attitude, how we approach it. Do we make it public enemy number one? Do we make it an obstacle? Do we make it a problem? Because this is very much the difficulty that happens in meditation. We have thinking happening, and then we say, I don't want to think. And so then we have thinking in the meditation, we also have aversion. So we have the two of these obstacles running at the same time. And the aversion, of course, that's an energy that feeds the thinking. So it continues and becomes more problematic. So it's very important that when we, in meditation, when thinking is happening, we just reflect. This is natural. What do I expect? And also that we have loving kindness towards ourselves, to what we're experiencing, whether it be a lot of thinking or any negative emotions that are coming up at that time. And when we have this loving kindness or acceptance of the thinking, it by itself will reduce. It will become less of a problem because we've ceased to see it as a problem. We're relating to it in a positive way. Unfortunately, when we relate to our experiences, whether it's thinking and meditation or negative experiences in our daily life, if we react, with negativity, anger, irritation, annoyance, jealousy, any of these negative emotions, we're just compounding the situation. We know that, actually many people know that. But if we add the ingredient of acceptance of what's happening, loving kindness for ourselves at least on those occasions, then things can change. Then the meditation can become peaceful. One of the big benefits of doing a little bit of Maitri, loving kindness, at the beginning of the meditation is that it reduces the hindrances. It's a very good antidote. And it's a very pleasant mind state. And of course, the whole point of Maitri is to develop the feeling, not just the words. The words, quite useful, can be quite useful. But if they become just like a rote, if they become like a parrot, then they're not touching the heart. They're not developing that feeling of Maitri, friendliness to ourselves and to others. So that's very important. And one of the major things in meditation if there's a lot of thinking, is to give the mind some work. Give it something to be more interested in. Because by and large, isn't it, our thinking becomes more prominent if the mind is not happy to be where it is, if the mind is a bit bored with it, if the mind is restless, it will go to the thinking, which is the way we live. So at that time, and this evening we'll use some of this, you can give the mind some work. And part of that can be like, as I suggested, doing some Maitri or a bit of visualization can be very helpful at the beginning of a meditation. And this evening we'll use a little bit of visualization. It's a bit like Maitri. We'll visualize giving a gift of loving kindness to ourselves and giving a gift of peace and acceptance to ourselves. And that can be very useful. It gives a little bit of work. And it may arouse a more positive mind state, so it's very useful. And the other things we can do that are more physical, for instance, if the mind is thinking a lot, is to do some deep breathing. 3 deep breaths at the beginning of the meditation, quite useful. I notice the effect immediately, it clears the mind of thinking temporarily. And Ajahn Chah, a famous meditation master from northeast Thailand, he used to recommend that, you know, in meditation, if there was a lot of thinking, just do a deep breath and then come back to the meditation object. And what that does is it breaks the chain and the chain of thinking, and then one can return to the meditation object. So this evening we'll try 3 deep breaths. You can do more than 3, though I once was teaching 6. One of the people said they felt dizzy. So I thought, oh well. So I would say do as many as you feel comfortable with. So that's good. And then this evening we can follow the breath. So this is another technique that Ajahn Chah, the Thai meditation master, used to teach, of following the breath from the nose, where it enters the body, to the chest, to the abdomen, and then back up from the abdomen to the chest to the nose, and just keep following it. That way it gives the mind something to do, because we're habitual doers, aren't we? Everybody's used to doing. And so if we haven't got anything to do, we'll just think, you know, probably about doing. So it's very useful to give the mind a little bit of work. And that's another thing we can do, is to follow the breath. And then after that, I was going to introduce the mantra of a visualization too, of giving loving kindness to ourselves on the in-breath, and on the out-breath, giving peace out to the world. And when you use a mantra, it can be very useful for influencing the mind, giving the mind this feeling of more maitri, more peace. So it can be very, very effective, especially if you couple it, if you use it with a visualization, it can be very useful. And there are other techniques too that we could use that are used traditionally. We won't use tonight, but you can use in meditation, like counting the breath. If you know one on the in breath one, on the out breath two, on the next in breath, sorry, on the in breath one, on the out breath one, on the next in breath two, on the next out breath two, and go up to say nine, and then count back on the. So eight on the in-breath, eight on the out-breath, seven on the in-breath, seven on the out-breath, and so on. I don't like counting, but some people do. And it's a very good way to focus the mind, because you'll soon notice that if your mind has gone off, you won't know where you're up to, and then you have to start over again. So that's very useful. And some people like visualizations. So you can have an image of, like, I like the ocean, with the waves coming in, like the breath coming in, and then when the wave goes out, the breath going out. And so you can make it more interesting for the mind. It's more work, it's more interesting, and that's an important ingredient for meditation. The mind will stay wherever it is interested, wherever it's happy. If the mind is not interested, if the mind's bored or restless, it will go off all over the place. So that, this evening we will use the ones I described, but those other ones are also possible. So now it's time for the... People can talk about meditation for hours, but it's better to do the meditation. So we have a guided meditation now for about half an hour. So if you'd like to make yourself comfortable, you're probably already reasonably comfortable. It's important that one is comfortable, because if the body isn't comfortable, then the meditation will be disturbed by that. So, and we can close the eyes and just to check how the body is, that we feel that it's comfortably aligned, that it's the feet are in a good position, the back in a good position. It doesn't have to be ramrod straight, not rigid, but relaxed, but reasonably erect. And now we can bring our attention to relaxing the body, and we can be aware of the right foot and the right leg. And on the in-breath, we can tighten the right foot and the right leg. And just hold it. And as we breathe out, relax, relax, relax. And now we bring the attention to the left foot and the left leg. And as we breathe in, we tighten it, the left foot and the left leg. And as we breathe out, we relax it. And just appreciate, feel the relaxation. And now the sitting area, we tighten that as best we can as we breathe in, and as we breathe out, relax that area. And now we move the attention to the stomach area, the abdomen and stomach area, and we tighten that as we breathe in. And as we breathe out, we relax. And now we move up the body to the chest. And breathing in, we tighten the chest area. And we relax as we breathe out. And now we move the attention to the right hand and the right arm. And as we breathe in, we can tighten the right hand and the right arm. As we breathe out, we can let go, relax. And now we move to the left hand and the left arm. And breathing in, we tighten that. As we breathe out, we relax, let go of the tension. And now we bring the attention to the shoulders. And as we breathe in, we raise the shoulders as far as we can. And as we breathe out, we relax the shoulders. And now we can move the shoulders backwards and forwards. So it just a few times. And then bring the attention to the mouth area. Gets a lot of work. And we can, on the in-breath, we can tighten that area. And on the out-breath, relax that area. And now we move up the face to around the eyes. And as we breathe in, we tighten that area. And as we breathe out, we relax. And now we move to the forehead and the top of the head. And we tighten that, and as we breathe in. As we breathe out, we relax. And now, just experience the body as it is, sitting. And move the attention from the top of the head. We go through the body, relaxing it, just giving it some Maitri. Allowing it to relax, let go of any tensions from the top of the head, down through the face, to the shoulders. Down the right arm, down the left arm, the back, the chest, the abdomen, the right leg and foot, and the left leg and foot. Just relaxing, giving it a gift of Maitri. And now we bring to mind our intention for meditating. It's always good to have an intention, some idea of why we're meditating, just to have acceptance and peace of whatever we experience, be it thinking or whatever emotions come up, whatever thoughts, to have this acceptance and peace. Now we can visualize giving ourselves, giving our minds this gift of kindness, of peace, of acceptance, so that it can let go of all the other preoccupations, just to be with our mind, with our body, here in the present moment, with kindness, acceptance, and peace and appreciation. And we can take three deep breaths just to make sure we're in the present moment. Breathing in and breathing out. Breathing in and breathing out. Breathing in and breathing out. And now we can just follow the breath for a time from the nose to the chest to the abdomen. And then from the abdomen to the chest to the nose, in and out, following the breath.
Thank you.
And now we can let go of following the breath and just remain wherever the breath is most prominent for us, whether it be the nose, chest, abdomen, wherever. And to notice the breath coming in and visualize giving yourself a gift of Maitri, of loving kindness, of metta as you breathe in, filling the body and mind with this Maitri. And as you breathe out, breathing out this gift of peace to the world, to all beings here and everywhere. So we breathe in this gift of Maitri and breathe out this gift of peace. And now, as we're coming close to the end of the meditation, we can just reflect for a few moments on how we feel and what has brought up this feeling, what has caused it to arise. And now we share the energy, the merit, the pin of this meditation with all the beings here and everywhere, particularly with the person who's just passed away. We'll do more of that at the end. That they may develop more kindness, acceptance of the difficulties in their life, the difficulties of their thinking, of their mind states, and may they develop more peace, gentleness, kindness for themselves and others. And we can finish with the aspiration: may I develop more and more kindness, more and more acceptance and peace and tolerance around difficult situations in my life, in my mind, the thinking particularly, so that I can come to peace, can develop understanding and wisdom. So now we can slowly open the eyes and come out of the meditation and move the body to make ourselves more comfortable. So I hope you found that beneficial. I must admit, I felt that it was quite peaceful, and people were very settled. Sometimes, you know, when I'm conducting these guided meditations, I can feel a certain restlessness in the group, and maybe it's in my mind, because often what we see around us, isn't it, what we experience, is actually coming from us. You know, so it's quite interesting. You're never quite sure whether it's other people or ourselves. So no, it felt quite peaceful. And did people find the visualization helpful? That visualizing, breathing in loving kindness, breathing out peace, and also the deep breathing. That can be very, very useful. And as I say, if you have a lot of thinking happening during the meditation, follow Ajahn Chah's recommendation to take a deep breath and then go back to it. But the important thing, of course, don't have aversion to the thinking, just to bring up the breath, have the deep breath and see what happens. And of course the following the breath, that's quite useful too. The point of giving work, as I say, to the mind, it takes its attention away from the thinking. But we don't want to give too much work to the mind. We have enough during the day. I think everyone has enough in the mind. And also, if we have too much work in the meditation, it's very hard for the mind to come together, to develop samadhi, to get very, very peaceful. So with meditation, it should tend to be more and more simple, and that way take you to a much deeper level. It's interesting too that the Buddha recommended breathing meditation, anapanasati, as an antidote to thinking. And I think it does work, but of course, you know, when we sit down to do, say, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, half an hour of meditation, it won't work immediately, because the momentum of our thinking, of our minds, is such that it takes a while to slow down. So, the theme for this evening, as I said, was the thinking, is it a blessing or a curse? And how do we relate to it in our lives, just basically in our lives and meditation? So do many people think thinking is a blessing? Anybody here think thinking is a blessing? Philosophers do. they think it's wonderful. And do many people think it's a curse? Really there's a third position, isn't there? Is it a blessing sometimes and a curse sometimes? And usually our thinking is a bit like that, because we can use it, can't we, in a very wholesome way. We're using thinking when we do visualizations, when we're doing the meditation. We're using some guided thinking, some kusala thinking. So it has its uses, but it also causes people a lot of suffering that is in their lives. So this is why I thought this would be a very interesting subject for this evening. And it's important to remember, as I said before, thinking is natural. And as the Buddha, for instance, some people may be surprised to hear that the Buddha actually thought. He's actually experiencing thinking is probably the more accurate term. And he said in one of the sutras in the Majjhima Nikaya, he said that he divided his thoughts into two categories, wholesome and unwholesome. And the unwholesome ones, the unwholesome thoughts, he worked at abandoning in whatever way he could, he let go of them. And the wholesome ones, he said, I could think them as long as I wished, a day and a night, and there would be no problem with that. But, he said, if I did that, all this thinking of wholesome, positive thoughts, he said, that would tire the body. And he said, if my body is tired, the mind will not come together, samadhi will not develop. So this is why the Buddha didn't continue with the positive thinking, the wholesome thinking, because we can go beyond it. He went beyond it. He went into deep states of meditation that empowered the mind, gave it that strength to see things in a very, very deep way, which thinking can't do. It can't do. So the basic problem, isn't it, with our thinking is not thinking per se. It's where it's coming from, isn't it? You know, if it's coming from the negative side of things, you know, a lot of desire, greed, a lot of wanting, a lot of negativity, you know, irritation, annoyance, anger, hatred maybe, all from delusion, you know, particularly the most big part of delusion is this idea of ourselves, isn't it? This causes us a lot of problems and takes up a lot of the thinking. So if it's coming from these sources, these roots, then the thinking will naturally, in and of itself, be suffering. It will cause us a lot of problems. But thinking, as I said, per se, is not a problem if it's coming from wholesome thoughts, coming from a wholesome source. And thinking, as I say, many people celebrate thinking, and the philosophers do. There have been a lot of philosophers, whether in the East or the West, and they celebrate thinking. You know, we have, of course, the famous saying by René Descartes, the French philosopher, I think, therefore I am. Interesting. And I think most people think like that, really. They think, I'm thinking, that's me. You know, so this is what most people think, you know, or many people think. Philosophers celebrate it. But I always ask people to reflect. You know, I've only read a little bit about philosophers' lives, their backgrounds. But the little I have read, they don't seem like very happy, content people. So what good is all these thoughts? Actually, philosophers in the West, they call them great thinkers, actually, great thinkers. But to me, it doesn't seem to have brought them the benefits and fruit that you would expect. If you have developed a philosophy that is an understanding of life, it should bring peace, it should bring happiness and wisdom. But if it's only thinking, if it's only at that level, it's not enough. Because the Buddha, of course, he was pointing to And this is what meditation points to, going beyond thinking, the limitations of thinking. So this is a very important important thing to consider. Thinking, of course, is useful at times, isn't it? We have to do planning, we have to do problem solving, and remembering. It has its uses and we have to use it. But we should also be well aware of its limitations and not put all our trust in thinking. Because I think everybody is quite well aware that with our thinking we can create these stories, can't we? And these stories of what other people think about us, what we think about ourselves actually. And these can create a lot of anxiety and stress in our lives and fear. And we can have negative thinking about the past. That's usually concerned with the future, isn't it? Often with the future. And we can think negatively about the past as well, giving rise to depression. Because we go over and over these thoughts, these negative thoughts of perhaps what other people think of us or what we think of ourselves. And this thinking is where it becomes very negative is when it harnesses the power of this strong desire, strong negativity and delusion. There's a good portion of it is delusion. And there's a nice story, quite humorous story, of a Sufi teacher. They say he actually existed in the 9th century, 8th century, around there, in Turkey. And his name was Nasruddin. And he's a very humorous teacher. There are lots of very funny stories that I like, actually. I like them very much. And recently I had received a book with some more of his stories, which was quite interesting. But on one occasion, Nasruddin was walking on the outskirts of the village. He was on the outskirts of the village. And he saw these horsemen, these men on horses, approaching. And he started thinking, oh my goodness, they're going to capture me and sell me into slavery. I'll never see my family again. They'll take me away from my village, my country. Oh my goodness. And then he thought, oh no, they're going to put me in the army. They'll force me to join the army and I'll be fighting and I'll be killed and my family will lose their support. My wife and my children will lose their support. And he thought, what to do? And he looked around and he saw that there was a cemetery nearby. So he rushed into the cemetery and there was an open grave. And he thought, oh good. And he lay in the grave. He jumped into the grave and lay down there, hoping that they wouldn't see him. Of course, the horsemen, what did they see? They saw this strange person behaving in a very funny way. They thought, is this a spy? Is this a criminal behaving like this? Why is he doing, where is he gone? He just disappeared. So they rode up and looked around the cemetery, and there they found him lying in the tomb, lying in the open grave. And they said to him, what are you doing lying in this grave? And Nasruddin said to them, I am here because of you, and you are here because of me. And it's true. And it's the stories that they each were telling, you know, like Nasruddin's stories about them selling him into slavery or forcing him into the army. Their stories that he might be a criminal or a spy or some sort of agent. So this is how our lives go. We make up these stories. Sometimes this is a very humorous story, so it's quite funny. Yes, and one of the sayings I recently came across actually, and I thought is an example of this: the stories that we tell, the imaginations that come up through thought, and the negative emotions. And this one I like actually. It says the greatest prison that people live in is the fear of what other people think. And it's true, isn't it? How do we know what they think? Good heavens. I remember one time in Melbourne, I think it was a POIA program I was conducting. I think it was a WESAC. And it was going quite nicely, but I noticed one woman, she looked terribly bored. And I thought, oh, gee, she's really finding it very dull and, you know, hard going. And you know, I thought, she looked like it the whole day. And I thought, oh, goodness, she's not finding it useful at all. You know, maybe the approach is not good for her or whatever. So I had this perception. Then at the end of the day, she came to thank me and she actually cried. And I thought, my goodness, my perception, the story that I thought was she's bored, you know, or, you know, not finding it at all useful. So it just shows you the stories we can make up about what we think other people are thinking. And I'm sure all of you know that saying. There is a saying that I quite like. I've always liked it, actually. That in our 20s, we're really worried, we're really concerned about what other people think of us, particularly anyone we're interested in romantically. So that's very true. And we're very concerned. In our 30s, when we're a bit more stable and more established in life, we tend to think we don't care what people think, so we're a bit more defiant, rebellious. And then when we get to our 40s or 50s, we realise people aren't thinking about us at all. So think, who are they thinking about? Themselves. So this is actually the truth of it, you know, this whole business of worrying about what people think, by and large they're not thinking about us. But it takes us until our 40s or 50s usually before we realise that and can let go of it. So that's very, very useful. And the other aspect of negative thinking, these stories in a way, it is the same theme, isn't it? Is stress. You hear a lot about stress, don't you? What is stress? It's thinking, isn't it? It's thinking we've got so much to do and not enough time. I've seen it myself. You have a whole list of things you've got to do and you keep running over the list and, you know, I haven't got much time, this list, I've got to do this, got to do that. And then one gets stressed. So this is again, you know, thinking getting out of control. This is again believing this thinking actually and not being in the present moment. And I know Ajahn Brahm has quite a good story about this too. Well, it's interesting, and I think it's true. I've seen it in my life, and I see it in I've seen it in other people's lives too. That often thinking makes things very difficult. The doing, not a problem. So Ajahn Brahm, he relates this story in, I think, Opening the Door of Your Heart, that when he was a monk in Thailand, they had all these every poya, every week. Every week they would have an all-night sit meditation during the night, and so they were very, very tired after it. And then the next morning, on this occasion, the head monk asked one of the monks to wash a lot of his robes, and he was completely tired from the whole night sitting, you know, meditation for the night, and he was really upset. That he had, because washing the robes in that situation means you have to boil water, you have to chop up jack wood and boil that, and then put the robes in a container and do them individually actually to wash them, and it's quite a procedure. So Ajahn Brahm saw this monk, he was really upset, you know, because why would the monk ask him, his senior monk, chief monk, ask him to do that after an all-night sit? That's really unkind. How dare he do that? You know, and all this. He was really suffering. And then Ajahn Brahm went to him and said, you know, doing it is not much of a problem. Thinking about it is a big problem. And it's true. And, you know, I found even very, you know, when I'm thinking of doing, fixing something or other, if I think about fixing it, often it gets very complicated. If I just go to it, somehow I can do it without a lot of thinking. So thinking can be very difficult in that sense. And I know there was one story I liked from an American teacher, Byron Katie. She is a person who actually works with thinking all the time, and her teaching is about thinking, dealing with thinking, and it's very interesting. And she was in Israel on one occasion. She teaches all around the world. And she met this, she does quite a bit of work in prisons. And she met this American man who was in an Israeli prison. He was in the prison because he'd murdered his girlfriend. And So she did some work with him, and the reason he murdered her was because he thought she was having an affair. Everything he thought, you know, he saw her with other men, and he was sure that she was having an affair, and he'd see proof all over the place. And then when he did this, he met Byron Katie and did this investigation into, was that really true? He found out there wasn't really any proof at all for it, for the fact that, you know, she was having an affair. He had no proof whatsoever. And actually that was a great breakthrough for him. It released him from that. So this is where the power of thinking can really lead us. This is a pretty serious one, isn't it? But you all probably know people who are very jealous, and when jealousy is running, it can do very negative things, can't it? So this is the power of negative thinking, in a sense. And to give us just an exercise to do here, and one that I think brings home the point very well, I've seen it for myself, is if you just imagine someone hasn't returned your telephone call, they don't ring you back, or they haven't answered your email, it's important, and they haven't answered it. I think we've all had this situation. And what happens? The stories start, don't they? The stories start. You, most commonly, people think, they're upset with me. They're angry with me. They didn't like what I said, the message I left on the telephone or the message I wrote in the email. And you can just see how the stories can begin and how they get going. But the most important thing for us all, actually, is to understand thinking. This is the way we can actually deal with thinking the best. Because if we understand thinking, then it hasn't got the power that it normally has. Thinking derives power from two things. I've just mentioned them now. Thinking derives power from believing it, for one thing. That's the first mistake we make. We believe all the thoughts that we have. The second, and this is what really empowers thinking, is they're my thoughts. I am thinking this. Those two things make thinking very powerful. If we didn't believe thinking, if we didn't own thinking, then it doesn't have much power at all. So the first thing about the nature of thinking is that it's conditioned. We think it's our thinking, but actually it arises from the way we've thought in the past, from our education. And education, isn't it, is a process of developing our thinking, really enhancing it. And this is what education is aimed at, increasing our thinking. A lot of our thinking has been conditioned by our society we're in, our friends, our television, all the things we read. Many different things condition it. And I think of thinking actually very much like this predictive software you see for word processing, for emails. It's very common these days, where you just put one letter and it predicts what you're going to write. And it's uncanny how after a short time it can predict very accurately just the words, even phrases to a certain extent. But what it does point to is that it is conditioned. It is conditioned. We don't realize it because that sense of self which owns the thinking, I'm thinking, I'm thinking this thought. But of course the proof of that pudding is that you try and stop thinking that thought. If it's your thought, if it's our thought, we can stop it. Can we? No. It's the trouble, isn't it? And that's when thinking gets out of hand. So if you can try that sometime. I'm not going to think. I just say that now. Anybody not thinking? If you are, you're really good. You're doing very well. And the Buddha said part of the conditioning process is is a cycle of three factors. He was talking about them. They're called the vipalasas. If we have a view of a situation, of a person, of ourselves, of our society, whatever it is, we have a view, then we will tend to perceive that person, that situation, in a particular way. We'll have a view, then we'll perceive them in a particular way, and then we will think about it. An example is if we think someone doesn't like us, we have this view, so-and-so, he or she doesn't like me, you know, they are not very friendly when I meet them, they don't come and see me very often or whatever. And then we will tend to look out, as it were, for things that are perceptions that confirm that. Oh, she came today and she walked straight past me, and she spoke to this person and that person, but not me. And then we'll start thinking those sorts of thoughts. Why did she do that? She doesn't like me. I'm sure she doesn't like me. And then that will increase the view. So the Buddha said, in this way, we, as it were, develop our thinking. We condition our thinking and make it stronger and stronger. But the good news that the Buddha gave, is that we can actually reprogram the mind. Because it's conditioned, we can do something about it. That's good. We can recondition, just like you can recondition a car. We can change it. And the Buddha actually talked about becoming masters of thought. He didn't say to become completely without thought, but to become masters or mistresses of thought. So, and he said, a master of thought or mistress of thought will think what they wish to think and will not think what they don't want to think. So this is mastery when we can do that. And it's quite interesting that the Buddha, when Venerable Ananda was extolling all the incredible qualities of the Buddha, many wonderful stories of his birth and from the Tusita heaven, coming down completely mindful, aware, and walking seven steps, all this, the Buddha came up at the end of it. He said, but Ananda, think this is another miraculous or wonderful and amazing quality of the Tathagata, the Buddha, that he can be aware of feelings, perceptions, and thoughts as they arise, when they're present, and when they pass away. So the Buddha had that degree of awareness, incredible awareness, of what was happening in the mind, moment by moment. And that is real mastery for me, anyway. So, and it's important to, as I said before, to realize that thinking doesn't belong to us. Because it is conditioned, because we can't control it, how could it be ours? If it were really ours, if it belonged to us, if it weren't conditioned, then we would have some control over it. But of course, you know, when the mind is stirred up, when there's a lot of desire in the mind, or a lot of negative qualities, jealousy, competitiveness, or delusion in the mind, confusion or concern with self, then, you know, the thinking gets really out of hand. And I think we've all experienced times when the thinking has taken on a momentum of its own. It's very difficult to deal with. So this shows us for certain that thinking doesn't belong to us. But if we realize that, that makes a big difference. We don't have to own all the thoughts. We don't have to react to all thoughts. We don't have to do all the things we think. They are happening. If we have this understanding that they don't belong to us, we can do or not do them. We have a choice. But if we think they're us, we have very little choice. There's very little space there to work. And there's a nice story, again, from Nasruddin that I like. Is one day Nasruddin was upstairs in his house and his wife was downstairs, and during the evening suddenly there was this big thud, this real a crash upstairs. So Nasruddin's wife, who was downstairs, said to him, Nasruddin, what's happened? Are you okay? And he said, my cloak just dropped on the floor. And she said, but Nasruddin, it was a very loud crash. How can that be? And he said, I was in it. And that's the trouble with our thinking. We're in it. And because of that, there's a very loud crash. But if we weren't in it, if it was just the cloak dropping on the floor, then it wouldn't be a problem at all. Well, it would be a small problem, you know, maybe this negative thinking or whatever, but we wouldn't be owning it, we wouldn't be in it. So this is quite a humorous way of looking at it. And also, as you remember, that Descartes, that quotation from Descartes, I think, therefore I am. That's very much that idea, you know, that we are what we think. But in reality, we are much, much more than that. And this is where meditation particularly helps, because we become aware that there's a level of awareness and knowing which doesn't use thinking and which is much, much deeper than thinking. Thinking is a rough approximation of reality. It's our interpretation, isn't it, of what's going on around us, and is somewhat useful for that, for the information it can give us. But awareness and knowing are far deeper, and in meditation, thinking can stop completely. Can stop completely. And in the, for instance, the very deep meditations, isn't it, the jhanas, which the Buddha experienced, thinking, there is no thinking. But there is complete awareness and sharpness and bliss and incredible happiness there. And this is without thinking. Often people have the idea, don't we, you know, many people do, especially in the West, that thinking is knowing, thinking is awareness, but it isn't. In fact, it's actually like an obscuration. It's actually making, like fog, like dust. It's actually making being aware and knowing what's going on much more difficult, much less clear. It's obscuring it. So this becomes particularly obvious in meditation. And of course, mindfulness is another example that when we're mindful, we're in the present moment. And thinking may be happening, and we are aware in the present moment, yes, thinking is happening, but we're not caught up with the content of thinking, the story, the thought, whatever. And the difference between thinking and being aware, for instance, is, for instance, we can think this room is too cold, or it's too hot, the chair's too hard, or maybe not too soft, or when is this going to finish, that sort of thing. But actually, awareness would just be coolness or heat if it was warm for you, or hardness if the chair was hard, or if there's thinking going on, thinking happening. That would be awareness. So when we're thinking, it's really like a description. And a lot of our thinking, isn't it, is a commentary. It's a commentary on what's happening around us. And it's an effort to put it all together, to interpret it, to understand. It's quite amusing for me because my signaler is not so good. It is good enough. But so I often get the story wrong. So, I mean, things happen. And my understanding of it, I think, wow, why do they do that? And then later I hear, you know, and I understand, and then I think, oh, right, oh, no, that makes perfect sense. Yes, yes, I can see now. So this is the difference between, you know, thinking and just being aware. So that's very useful with mindfulness. And it's important to realize that, too, that thinking isn't reality. That is, as I've pointed out before, that is a very important thing to understand. And I mentioned that with that example. And so the strategies for dealing with thinking in meditation and in daily life is, first of all, our attitude, isn't it? That's so important. Not to add negativity to the situation. With thinking, we can either encourage it, and we give it a lot of energy, or we can be averse to it and try and push it away, get rid of it, Neither of those two things work very well. Of course, if we give it a lot of energy, we're interested in it, it'll get going more and more. And if we have a lot of aversion, negativity, it will actually increase it too. So the point to be is to have sort of loving kindness, to have acceptance, tolerance, kanti, patience is good, towards the thinking, not trying to get rid of it. And a good example, of course, is the famous story by Ajahn Brahm that when he was a young monk and he was able to leave the monastery and live on his own in a cave, I think it was, and he found that the thinking was getting out of control, and he said that they were very unmonkly thoughts. And no matter what he did, you know, all day, you know, during his meditation, the thinking would come and disturb the meditation. So in despair, he made like an adhisthana that for 1 hour in the afternoon, he would allow any thinking whatsoever, no matter what it was. And so in the that would be in the afternoon. So he got ready for it and he sat down and said to the mind, right, go for it, it's your hour. No thoughts at all. You could stay with the breath, every breath. So this shows to us, doesn't it, that if we have a lot of aversion for thinking, or on the other hand, the other extreme isn't it, a lot of interest in thinking, it feeds the thinking. But if we can just accept it, allow it, and watch it, be as it were, just watch it, stand back from it, that is very useful. So, and the other strategies that are, of course, very useful is understanding the nature of thought, which we've talked about, particularly that it's conditioned and that it's not ours. Those two are very, very useful. And a very important one is, and the Buddha encouraged this, is to develop right thought, sammasankappa. So there is right thinking, actually. And these are thoughts that are coming from wholesome emotion. So the Buddha said that thoughts of renunciation or giving up, not trying to get sensual pleasures, not trying to get this and that, but giving things up, giving things away, is right thought. We can develop this. And maitri, or thoughts of non-ill will, is the way the Buddha put it, this is right thinking. And also thoughts of not harming others, compassion, this is right thinking. So if we do more of this, there's less space for the mind to have negative thoughts. And this is another way of dealing with it. And often, you know, the problems we have with thinking come from negativity in reality, you know, that either negativity towards ourselves or others. So if we have maitri in the mind, there's not so much of a concern or fear what others may think, and there's not so much negativity towards ourselves, not so much criticism towards ourselves. That's a very useful way of doing it. One thing that I like to encourage too is, I think it's quite effective, is to look on, this is a part of not owning thinking, looking on thinking as not, as being somebody else's. You know, like if you were standing in a queue and listening to two people talk, it's very unlikely that you'd get very upset. You wouldn't think this is my thoughts or my conversation. You wouldn't get upset. In the same way, we can look on our thoughts as not being my thoughts, they're just these thoughts that are happening, like another person's thoughts, and not own it. And then we're not so caught up in the story. We can watch it, we can think, well, we can have a choice. Actually, that's an important thing, to have a choice. And another very important one, and this just to finish off almost with it, is to investigate thinking, not to believe it. And I mentioned Byron Katie before, and she has they're very Buddhist actually, very interesting way to investigate thinking, and it's very effective actually, very liberating for people, is to ask whatever thought is really giving us a lot of problems, a lot of grief, a lot of suffering, to ask if this thought is true. And of course, usually people say straight away, yes, of course, absolutely true. And then the next one she asks is, can I know that this is absolutely true? Of course you can't. You know, you think this is the case, you know, this person is being really nasty to you because of this, that, and the other. We can't know for absolutely true, if that's absolutely true. And then the third one is, how do I feel when I think this thought? This is the body and the mind. You know, what does it do to my body and mind? Of course, I'm usually very upset. And then the last one, which is very useful, is the important one. How would I feel if I never thought this thought? That's powerful, because you realize when you do that, you realize it's this thought that's making me miserable, this thought that's giving me this suffering. And it really, that makes you, it makes me anyway, see, this is not reality, this is just a thought, and yet it's causing me grief. So that's quite a very useful way of dealing with thinking. And the last way that's quite useful, is very useful too, is to develop kanti. I mentioned that before, develop patience. So, but this is sort of patience that doesn't have ill will in it, but it's patience that can bear with it, this thinking, and not react to it negatively. And realize, kanti always realizes, it has that element of wisdom, doesn't it? This will pass, this too will pass. And of course, that's another a way of regarding thinking. Whatever thinking one is experiencing, even if it's obsessive, continuous, it will pass. And so kanti knows that. So these are some strategies for dealing with thinking that can be useful in your life, in our lives, and in meditation. So I hope we can use them. So whether it's a blessing or a curse, up to us. It can be more of a blessing if we know the true nature of thought, if we don't own it, and if we don't believe it. These two factors are the crucial ones I found in my life, and that believing them and owning them, they're two of the major reasons for us suffering with thought. We can use it, and then we can use it wisely and well. So I'd like to finish there and to ask if there are any questions about what I've said, anything really, and or about the meditation. As Buddhists, should we go to the temple? If so, how often, and what would be best for us to do whilst at the temple? Good, isn't it? When I read that, I thought, wow. As Buddhists, should we go to the temple? I think that's completely up to us, isn't it? Whether we find it inspiring, useful, uplifting, beneficial for our development of the Eightfold, the Noble Eightfold Path, that's up to us, really. And it will depend, you know, on the temple. Some temples, one will find, you know, the monks teaching them very inspiring. Other places, not so inspiring. So, for instance, today I'm staying at Lanka Vipassana, and today Mahamevna had a program at Lanka Vipassana, Vipassana Bhavana Majestani in Vijayarama Mawata. And many, many people, and they obviously find that very inspiring and useful. So go to the temples that inspire and you find very useful for your practice. Don't go to the ones that don't. It's very, that's a good point. And sometimes it's difficult if it's your local temple and you've had a long association with it. It's difficult for maybe Buddhists in that situation because they feel an obligation, maybe. Maybe that's what they're talking about too. So going to the temple, if so, how often and what would be best for us to do whilst at the temple? So again, how often you go is up to oneself and depends on the amount of time one has and the amount of benefit one derives. Often I see people where I often stay in Ratmalana, I look down on a temple. I see people coming all times of day and late at night even. And so people do find a lot of benefit in going to the temple just in the sense of developing peace. And I know it's a very common practice. If you've got an exam coming up, you go to the temple, make offerings. And I think maybe it helps make the mind a bit more peaceful too. So if you find by going to the temple, due to the associations with the temple, the conditioning that you have, that it brings some peace to you, good, good, that's a useful thing. And what you can do there, depending on whether there's a program happening or you're just there on your own, if you're there on your own, you can just do some meditation, maybe walking or sitting, whatever is most comfortable. And, you know, maybe even a little chanting if you find that good. So those things are very, very useful. And you don't have to go always on the Poya program, whenever it's convenient. Sometimes on the Poya program, it's probably pretty busy. So people may not find that very peaceful, actually. So whenever you find that it's useful. And I think particularly because of the association with temples, because of Pirit, it's on the radio, television, everywhere, people often find that quite peaceful and quite calming. So it has got its value in that sense. They may not understand it, but they have, you know, they've got that feeling. And they can use that for their meditation. You know, when you, if you find being at the temple quite peaceful, just when you start to meditate, bring the pansala to mind, you know, the chaitya and the sand and the aralia and bring that sense, because that will bring up peace in your mind if you have that association. And you can use that in your meditation. And you can be at the temple at home. So you can bring the temple to you, as it were, which is very can be very useful. So that's my response to that question. The person who asked this, probably not here. Nevertheless, thank you for it. Oh, yes, this is an interesting one. Maybe almost last. At times, I feel the presence of people at night in my room. Is this possible? How should I meditate in such situations? Right, that's interesting. Presence of people in my room. Well, I mean, two possibilities occur to me. This is obviously, you know, it can be the people in one's mind, you know, that they can, as it were, they're coming to one's mind and one is aware of them and thinks of them in the room. The other possibility is departed friends and relatives. It's possible they can come. Usually, if they come, they're coming for wanting merit or pin or maitri, that sort of things. So this is possible. Yes, it is possible. I think, how should I meditate in such situations? Just make the mind as peaceful as you can and just allow things to settle and then see what you experience, because then you know what's best to do, you know, whether to send some maitri, whether to just to bring to mind some pin you've made, merit you've made, and share that with them, whatever is appropriate in that situation. So that's interesting, yes. So I'd like to finish with those. And now, maybe just to conclude, we can share the merit of today. It's interesting that the Buddha said that meditating, and particularly if one develops awareness of arising and passing away, which is quite an advanced state, or one develops maitri for, I think, the time it takes to pull the udder of a cow, this is more merit than sila and pin. Than dana and sila. But I think he's talking about very deep states of maitri, loving kindness, and very deep states of wisdom, you know, of insight, jnana. Etavata chamehi sambhadam punya sampadam sambe deva anumodantu sambha sambhati sindhya sambe buddha anumodantu sambha sambhati sindhya sambe satta anumodantu sambha sambhati sindhya akasanta chambhumata deva naga mahi Indika punyang tang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanang chirang rakantu desanang chirang rakantu mang paranti imina punyakamena mame balasamagamo Satang samagamo tu yavani bana patya idang me punya kamang asavakaya vang ho tu sambaduka pamuchatu.